noir fiction, you know, especially when I started writing my first book, I watched a lot of movies from, you know, the 40s and 50s, sort of the black and white, very, very moody pictures. And I think a lot of what noir is about, you know, people who are sort of so much smaller than the system in which they live,
mm-hmm.
and that to a certain extent, you know, they struggle without much chance for success against sort of the larger forces in society. So I think there's both sort of a feel and then sort of a outlook that sort of defines noir,
yeah.
for me at least.
Right. And thrillers, we all sort of know what thrillers are, but what about dystopian fiction? Where do you see that falling with your work?
Well, you know, each of the books I sort of tackles an issue, and I think one of the ways that I thought about how do you illustrate and sort of comment on these issues is to take aspects I see of our society, or, you know, society from 20 or 30 years ago, and exaggerate parts of it so that particularly certain negative parts of it are brought more to the forefront,
mm-hmm.
and exaggerated a little bit. So that's kind of the way I approach dystopia. I know that, you know, in YA fiction, there's a lot of dystopia stuff right now, which I think is sort of more of a comment on, you know, teenagers' lives, you know,
right.
how their kind of outlook on things are. So I think that's a slightly different way of kind of framing dystopian setting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because I also often will associate dystopian books with futuristic, and it's funny because yours go back in time and sort of present an alternate reality that fits in that time period.
Yeah, and I think there's certainly other people who have done similar things. There's several books that they're sort of what if you know, the Nazis had invaded England successfully.
Right.
You know, and I think The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick talks about, I think it's the Japanese had taken over at least the west coast of the U.S. I haven't read it. I've read reviews of it. So anyway, I think that those are sort of other books that have tried to do similar things.
Okay. So in our last interview, we talked a little bit about the city that you've created as the setting for this series of books. I'm just wondering if we could talk about it a little bit once more, now that we're talking two books later and several years later, and how the city has changed as these books have progressed. A lot of time, as you mentioned, has passed. So how was that, writing the changes to the city?
Well, I guess the two books addressed it in two very different ways. Scorched City, which was the second book,
right.
which takes place around 1950. That book, a lot of it is about sort of race relations and sort of the where religion and politics and race relations all sort of intersect. So in that case, I really focused on a specific area of this fictional city, which was a sort of utopian, very poor utopian shanty town that was inhabited by sort of Afro-Caribbean people,
mm-hmm.
who were under the sway of a sort of cult leader, and so for that book, I really just sort of focused on a smaller. I mean, the rest of the city kind of plays a part, but there is sort of a central location where the action is focused. And then in the most recent book, Invisible Streets, which, you know, may be the last of this series, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to take a look at how do you organize an urban area. And in some ways, this is the way of sort of finally kind of examining, you know, this fictional city, is how do you, if when people kind of re-envision, if you take a look at a city that's you know, struggling economically, how do you go about sort of reorganizing it to try and revitalize a city? And if you do that, you know, what are some of the compromises you have to make and what are some of the sacrifices you have to make in other ways in order to make it sort of more economically viable.
It was really interesting to see the city change, this fictional city change, but change along the lines of real things that did happen, you know, in the 30s and in the 50s and in the 60s. And so that's been fun reading along. I wonder if, so you just mentioned that this may be the last book in the series. I think originally you were thinking it would just be three books. So I was curious about that because I would wonder if you wouldn't want to see this city into the 70s and the 90s and the new century. Are you tempted to do that? Do you know?
Yeah, I'm definitely tempted. And I kind of know, I have a basic sense of what the next book would be about. But right now I'm working on something a little bit different.
Okay.
And I don't know if that will sort of dominate my thoughts or whatever. And if there's, you know, if there's sort of a demand for another book in the city series. Mm-hmm. So I guess we'll kind of find out. We'll see how Invisible Streets does. And, you know, if my editor thinks it's a good time to write another one, I'd be really excited to do it.
Yeah.
But right now I'm just trying something a little different.
One of the things that I've read that you've said, and I thought it worked really well too, is that by spacing the books so far apart in time, each of them stands alone really well. And I think for a series, that's an interesting difference because a lot of times a series will pick up the life of typically, I think, you know, a detective or something 1 year later or 2 years later after the last case or whatever. So can you talk a little bit about how this is different?
Each of the books, there's about a 15-year gap in between them. And there are several reasons why I did this. One, as you said, which is that they can kind of stand alone a little bit. And I also, you know, you get these series where it seems like there's just like this constant crisis where each month the detective or each year the detective runs into this string of murders or what have you. So I kind of thought, you know, space it out a little bit, have it be, at least to my mind, a little more organic, that sort of these big crises don't happen quite as often as if you're going to write a 20-book series or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And it also allowed, you know, Frank Frings, who's a central character, to mature and for his views about things to have changed. And in a lot of ways, a lot of things that affect him are sort of off camera. They're taking place in the 15 years in between the books. But then I think with each book, he has like sort of subtle changes in his approach, in the way he thinks about how you sort of affect change in the city, how you deal with people, sort of how you balance like your ideology and your sort of core beliefs versus, you know, what effect those beliefs has when they're sort of applied to people.
Now, I want to talk about your three main characters. But before we talk about them, I want to talk a little bit about one of the characters whose role is very central to the plot, and that's Nathan Canada. And I know I read that you sort of loosely based him on Robert Moses, who was the master builder of New York City in the mid-20th century. Not that he's based on that person, but sort of takes that role in this city. So I wonder if you can talk about the experience of basing a fictional character on a historical character to some extent.
Okay, so what happened with this is that I hadn't heard of Robert Moses, but I guess if you live in New York City, there's no way you can avoid him.
Right.
So what happened is a buddy of mine who's a lawyer in San Francisco had read Robert Caro's book called The Power Broker about Robert Moses. It's about 1,200 pages long. And so what he did is he gave 10 of his friends a copy in the hopes that one person would actually read it and be willing to discuss it with them. Because it's pretty daunting volume, although it's really interesting. So what I did is I picked it up and I read about the first, you know, 75 to 100 pages, and I thought it was fascinating, and I thought that it would be an interesting character to have in a book. And And so I stopped because I didn't want to write a book about Robert Moses necessarily. I wanted to write a book about somebody, like, as you said, who sort of plays the same role.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of took what I thought were sort of, for me, sort of the very basic kind of interesting things about Robert Moses, which is that, you know, he had this very, very strong vision of what he saw the future of New York City being, and he was willing to do what it took to carry it out, including, you know, bulldoze over entire neighborhoods and relocate tens of thousands of people and just really remake the landscape of parts of New York, and just being so absolutely sure that you're right and you're willing to commit all these resources to it and you're willing to really sort of overwhelm any opposition that there is to your sort of grand designs. So right. I thought that as sort of an outline of a character was really interesting. So I didn't read any more because I didn't want to, again, like, you know, be getting into the specifics of Robert Moses' life. But Nathan Canada in Invisible Streets is really based on the idea of Robert Moses and the idea that you can have one person who has this sort of all-consuming vision that he is able to really make happen in a major urban area.
And have you finished the book since you wrote this one?
No, I haven't. You know, it's funny. It's hard with writing and then with kids and,
yeah.
and a job. Like I read, you know, maybe 20 minutes a night. And so a 1200 page book like that is, you know, 4 or 5 months.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Get through it all.
Right.
But it is actually, part of it was put into a few New Yorker articles and I read through those. So I got sort of the SparkNotes version, I guess.
Did your friend read Invisible Streets yet? I'm wondering how he reacted to having been the catalyst for this character.
Yeah, you know, he read an earlier draft, which was actually quite a bit different. He thought it was cool.
Yeah.
He thought it was cool that I thought that Moses was compelling enough to kind of go forward with that character.
I think it's cool that he bought 10 copies of that book for his friends. I feel like that's a really good literary citizen.
I know.
Supporting writers.
I feel badly that I did not end up reading the entire thing and having long discussions with him over the phone about it.
Well, you did your part, I think.
Yeah.
All right, so now let's talk about your main characters. You mentioned Frank Frings. He's this leftist newspaper man with a dependency on weed. And then there's Torsten Grip, and he's a cop. And then Nathan Canada's right-hand man, Phil Dorman, is your third main character. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about developing each of these characters and if you found yourself sort of attached in one to one more than the others as you wrote, or were there any surprises for you in how you felt about them by the end of the book?
Right. Well, so Grip actually started off in Scorch City. You know, he's a very sort of right-wing policeman who's sort of a strong-arm guy, is willing to sort of really toe the line of what's legal and what's not legal as far as dealing with suspects and stuff. And he's a very strong anti-communist. And when I was creating that character, I think the challenge for me that I kind of wanted to do was to create a character whose sort of point of view was really, really different from what mine was,
mm-hmm.
but also try and make him sympathetic and make his sort of worldview understandable,
mm-hmm.
even if you didn't necessarily agree with it, but that even though his outlook is different than mine, he's got sort of this inner morality that allows him to make decisions based on these sort of assumptions he has about our country and what's a threat to our country and what's not a threat to our country,
mm-hmm.
or this city. So that was really what I was trying to do with him, and he's sort of a contrast with Frings, who's very left-wing, and they're, you know, so they really line up on opposite sides of the political spectrum, and these are especially the last two are fairly political books. And then Dorman is who's Nathan Canada's right hand man. He's the one character in the whole series who's sort of an outsider.
Yeah.
I guess that's not quite true, but he's the only person who's sort of a main point of view character who's an outsider. So the idea with him was to take a person who is, you know, strong and kind of incorruptible, but at the same time, you know, not necessarily. He's willing to take sort of moral shortcuts to do what he needs to get done. But part of his experience is how he reacts to the way the city is, you know, and that the sort of endemic corruption and the different interest groups, particularly sort of ethnic groups in different neighborhoods, and how that sort of experiencing that affects him personally and sort of the changes he goes through as he kind of responds to sort of this overwhelming task that he has of trying to facilitate this sort of redesign of an entire city.
Mm-hmm.
Under Nathan Canada's instructions.
One of the things that I noticed when I was reading the book is that how well you give each of these characters an inner conflict. Do you mind if I read something about Torsten Grip, something from the book?
Sure.
Okay, let me see if I can find it here. Okay, so Grip knew that he came with an aura, that all cops whose partners were killed in the line of duty had one. It was the kind of thing that set him subtly apart, just a bit on the margins, despite the number of friends he had on the force and the far greater number who respected or feared him. It was a complicated weight to carry around, the burden of the dead partner. Every cop knew that about Morphy, and who didn't know Morphy, if only by reputation, felt a number of things at once. The horror, of course, this was every cop's nightmare. Pity for the guilt he had to live with, an anger that he had not been able to somehow rescue his partner, suspicion that maybe he wasn't a cop that you wanted watching your back. This final reaction, the doubt about his capabilities, was the one that festered in Grip, brought out the rage in him, and with it sometimes recklessness. I liked that whole very tight explanation of what's going on for him, and I just thought that was such an important conflict inside of him, and I think it relates to what you were saying about making him a sympathetic character, you know, giving him this struggle that he has to deal with. So I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about, I guess, the importance of inner conflict in strong characters.
Well, one of the things I thought was important for all sort of the main characters is that there be, you know, some ambiguity about them, that there's no, like, even though I think you would see Frings as being the protagonist of the series, that he's far from perfect.
Mm-hmm.
He's very flawed. So, you know, he, and part of Invisible Streets is really him trying to come to terms with the possibility that the way that he views the world may be obsolete, that he has these thoughts, and that this new generation of leftists is kind of challenging, and he's no longer as certain as he once was that he's correct. I think in order for characters to be, at least in my eyes, interesting, There needs to be ambiguity. There needs to be some kind of struggle. With Grip, you just read that about he's in Scorched City. He has a partner named Morphy, and in the intervening 15 years between Scorched City and Invisible Streets, he's killed in the line of duty, and so whereas in Scorched City, there's sort of these larger than life cops who are sort of admired and also kind of feared, that once they're no longer a tandem, that some of the sort of sense of invincibility that Grip had at one point, it kind of goes away. And then as the part you read, the sort of perception of him by other people on the force changes quite a bit mm-hmm. from sort of him being sort of a cop's cop and, you know, sort of a very manly guy to suddenly there's sort of cracks, you know, and he's sort of intensely aware of this and how that sets him, you know, somewhat apart, and that people who once sort of gave him a lot of respect, now that definitely comes with a little hesitation, or there's just like a little bit of a qualification in what they think of his competency as a police officer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was... It's funny because I almost kind of was thinking about what you said earlier, that he's not somebody I necessarily would have anything in common with, and yet I had sympathy for him, and I think that's a really hard thing to do sometimes. So, okay, another thing that's interesting about the book, which we did talk about a little bit, is these characters are not coming at things from the same perspective. And so we get this rich interweave of their perspectives on the different things that are happening in the book. And so, for example, we see Grip detain a man at one point. His name's Ben Linsky. And then later, Grip is told to back off of his pursuit of Linsky. And then we see Frank frings with Linsky, and we hear about Grip's coming after him, and we see Frank trying to work out what's going on. And it's really fun as a reader being allowed into the inner machinations of all of this, which I know a lot of novels do that, but in a way, because this novel is about the politics and inner workings of a fictional city, it was even a little bit more fun for me because it's a city I'm not familiar with, and so I'm learning about it as I go. Anyway, I wondered if that was part of the fun of writing the book and how that was for you.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that's sort of enjoyable about the early parts of the book is sort of the book writing process for me is sort of envisioning, you know, what is it like sort of socially, who are the people who are sort of the movers and shakers in the city at that time. So when I was thinking about a guy like Ben Linsky, who is sort of he's a radical, he's a poet, and then how does, like, if a guy like Grip thinks about him at all, what is his take on this person who he could not disagree with more
right.
about most things, and doesn't really have a whole lot of respect for him, you know, through the typical sort of manly, you know, tough police guy stuff.
Right.
Ben Linsky is not a, you know, physically imposing character. But then at a point, Grip, you know, is a little bit taken aback in that he seems to be physically brave. Like, he's willing to stand up. Linsky's willing to stand up to Grip when Grip tries to physically intimidate him.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of surprises him.
Right, because he's a poet.
Right, exactly. And so that gets into thinking, like, where does this guy... Where does he find the guts to stand up to me like this? And then Frings, on the other hand, you know, is absolutely sympathetic to the political aspects of things, and his real concern is sort of helping Linsky, who's also sort of a cultural tastemaker,
mm-hmm.
You know, exert an influence upon sort of the younger artists and even asking him to kind of draw back a little bit and not being so doctrinaire in the way he influences people. So yeah, I mean, I think that it's one of the fun things for me is just to kind of try and picture like the sort of community beyond even what gets written up in the book, but how would things flow? What would people think of other people? And that's stuff that doesn't necessarily make it onto the page, but sort of informs like, other actions that are going on,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been talking a lot about your main characters. I wanted to also just mention your wonderful sort of secondary characters. I wanted to just read another little bit, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
So there's this guy named Ed Wayne, and you describe him, and I just was like, oh my God, this description was so great. Grip shook hands with the two men, Albertson's grip hard, trying to prove something. Wayne's hand lay in Grip, soft and damp like an eel. "How are things, Ed?" Wayne shrugged. In truth, it was hard to imagine how things could be good for Wayne. A half dozen years ago, he'd been a cop, not a model cop, though effective in his own way. But then something had happened to him, some kind of rapid physical decline. He'd lost all of his hair right down to the eyebrows, and his chin seemed to have dissolved, his head tapering into his neck. He'd never been thin, but loose fat now hung sickeningly over his belt. And then a little while later you say, "Today he wore a pork pie hat on his bald head and tinted glasses," which had the odd effect of making him look like he was in costume. So I just was thinking, when I was reading that, I was remembering, I think, was it Forrester who used to talk about flat characters and round characters, and I was thinking, your secondary characters are not flat characters. You really fill them out with all of this detail that's so wonderful. So I wondered, like, do you just sit at your desk and come up with these descriptions, or do you go to the mall and write about the people who are walking by, or what do you do?
I don't know. Ed Wayne's kind of interesting in that he was in Scorched City and was sort of a corrupt cop who, you know, gets on the wrong side of these very poor Caribbean people in this community. But he's a very sort of hateful character, you know.
Right.
And so in some ways it was sort of, a reverse picture of Dorian Gray, where it's all his sort of hate not that Dorian Gray had hate, but all his hate and, seediness is actually, like, plays out on his physical self. So that was kind of the thought behind it. So then I was like, okay, how does this all work? And I, sort of had this, vision of this sort of, physically, a guy who's showing sort of the rotting of his soul,
mm-hmm.
on his body. So that's kind of where I came up from that. And I also think, I wish I could come up with a really good example right now, but there's also something kind of chilling about, it's particularly in movies, these, evil characters or bad guys who have this sort of strange, like almost comical style of presenting themselves.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of unnerving because you kind of feel like they've definitely got sort of a screw loose or whatever. So that was sort of another thing, is that I wanted, whenever Grip ran into him, to be sort of caught off guard by the fact that that Wayne just looks so strange, and the way he's presenting himself is so strange, that there's something really, really wrong with him in some ways. and that Grip is really trying to put his trust in him at different parts of the book, and he's like, "Is it really come down to this? This is the guy that I have to, rely upon to do things for me to keep me safe."
Yeah.
That was that, but I think the secondary characters, I mean, that's a place where you can, they should be fun and they should be somewhat memorable. I think Elmore Leonard does a really good job with that.
Yeah,
that all his sort of, the antagonists and the antagonist sidekicks and all these are always very sort of colorful and memorable guys.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and because the detail of the novel obviously makes the read that much more enjoyable, and the detail of these characters is part of that. It's not just about the main characters. So that was really fun. Okay, the book also concerns LSD and experimentation around LSD. So I was wondering how this became a part of the plot, and I know that it's hard sometimes to remember where something came from, but I was wondering if LSD was of particular interest to you, or if you put it in mainly because of the time period, or how that came to be.
Well, it actually, in earlier drafts, it was more of a focus in some ways, and I'd read a book, and I'm not going to be able to remember the title of it, but it was about sort of the early days of LSD when they were trying to figure out exactly what it was that they had, and guys like Timothy Leary doing mm-hmm. these crazy experiments, trying to figure out, is there you know, some higher form of enlightenment that we're getting out of this? Is it something where if everybody takes it together, there's some kind of common experience that we're having that's showing that it's something beyond just a chemical that we're putting into our brain? I had read it as doing a little bit of sort of background research for this book, and then I thought it was really interesting, so I thought maybe that would become more of a factor, and then so it was, and then in as we went through the revisioning process, and especially once I started working with my editor, that kind of got moved to more of a secondary aspect of the plot and the whole city, the urban planning part became the dominant plot line.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, originally the way it had been set up was that that whole sort of LSD thing was more of a central focus, and the changes to the city were something that the people who were involved in this sort of LSD group or whatever were becoming really concerned with. And they thought that they had these sort of theories about what the urban planning was really sort of accomplishing, you know, both intentionally and unintentionally. And, you know, one of the things that my editor and I sat down and talked at great length about was, does it make sense to have it be focused that way, where you have this group as the main focus and then the changes in the city as being something they react to, instead of having the changes of the city being the main focus and having this group be one of a few that's reacting to it and in sort of a, you know, more or less kind of paranoid fashion about what's actually being accomplished by this urban renewal.
Right.
And so that was kind of how that all went. It would have been a very different, like the second draft of the book, for instance, was quite a bit different than the one that finally made the shelves.
Okay. A lot of what this book has to do with is people with power and people without power. And there's this really poignant moment in the book, I thought. At one point, this powerless character named Peter Trukowski, who's trying to save his neighborhood from Nathan Canada's renewal. He says, "This cannot happen in America." I thought that was such a poignant moment. It can happen in America, and it could, and it still does. And I was wondering if this was a big part of what you were trying to convey in writing this book. And also, I was wondering if you see fiction as capable of working against the forces that allow this sort of corruption to happen in America. Not that the renewal is all about corruption, but there's a lot of corruption and a lot of displaced people. So do you feel like a work of fiction like this can actually work to fix any of this stuff?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, at a minimum, I would hope that it would encourage people to think about what's going on when changes are made to even on the level of a town. The town that I live in is having a lot of work done, where they're bringing in new retail space and getting rid of some of the older buildings and some of the sort of empty spaces, such as they are in sort of our little downtown. And businesses are being put in there. And, you know, there's arguments for and against doing it, but I think it's important for people to think about exactly, you know, what are we trying to accomplish when we do sort of major changes like this. You know, is it increasing our tax base? Is that the most important thing, or is it preserving sort of a look and feel to a town, or is it preserving sort of the way people's lives have been lived in a town over the course of decades, or is the change good? So I think, you know, those are the kind of things that, you know, in somewhat exaggerated fashion, I hope to sort of get across in the book, because I think it happens all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've gone to different places and done readings and sort of talked about what I was trying to get across, and every place was like, oh, yeah, this is just like, you know, this project that was being done, and they were trying to, you know, open, you know, a mall here, but they had to, you know, buy out all these people's farmland and they wouldn't sell. So it seems like those kinds of conflicts are going on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of times people aren't very, you know, it's sort of off to the side. It's not necessarily something that affects your day-to-day so much, but there are, you know, there's a lot of value judgments that are being made when you're making changes like this. And
right.
I think it needs to be sort of, people need to think about it in a sort of specific way in order to, you know, sort of take some ownership of what's happening to, you know, their community around them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember the town of Stowe here in Vermont, you know, which is a very tourist-oriented industry, and, you know, they've got the ski industry, and they have a certain look and a certain very New England charming look. And I remember when McDonald's wanted to go into Stowe, you know, the zoning committee said, okay, you can come in, but you cannot look like a McDonald's. You have to look like a building in Stowe. And that's ended up being what happened. And it does strike me that why don't more communities do that, or why don't more communities insist on that, but it must be really hard to do.
Yeah, you know, and I think there's sort of the unintended consequences, too, where somebody was telling me about a sort of small city near us, and they had an ordinance where they didn't want to have buildings above four stories,
mm-hmm.
Which seems like it makes a lot of sense, but he had talked to a builder friend of his who owns commercial real estate, and he said the problem with that is that in order to get enough money out of rent and stuff to make it all worth it, you end up making a box, like a four-story box, to mm-hmm. maximize the amount of square footage you have to rent. So where the idea was good is to keep buildings low, what you end up with is all these brick boxes, you know,
right.
just completely uninteresting buildings. That sort of changed the character completely from being sort of, you know, kind of slightly eccentric and unique, and then now you drop all these like big four-story brick boxes around them, and it really changes the character of things.
Like a Lego town.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Toby, I was wondering, what kind of research, if any, did you have to do before writing Invisible Streets? I know that you sort of started and didn't finish The Power Broker, and it sounds like you did some reading about LSD. So were there other areas that you purposefully researched in order to know what you were writing about better?
Yeah, you know, I read some philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
From the time, mostly sort of more radicals or existentialists, so like Sartre and Camus and Marcuse, who is a little more radical. So I did some of that. I watched a little bit of sort of 60s experimental film. I just tried to get a handle on sort of what, you know, before you get to the real full-on hippie era, like right before then, what were sort of the sort of cultural and philosophical sort of cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
And then using that is to kind of inform the sort of more bohemian aspect of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also did a little bit of reading about the anti-communists. And also Jane Jacobs, who is sort of the sort of most prominent critic of Robert Moses.
Okay.
And who's really a lot about, you know, having sort of mixed neighborhoods, sort of income-wise, and a mixture of residential and commercial properties and things like this. She has some very strong thoughts about how cities should evolve and how they should look, and was sort of the most prominent voice sort of opposing what Robert Moses was trying to do. Without a whole lot of success, but she is pretty well known.
Okay.
So that was kind of the stuff I did. I mean, I don't do the kind of research to the point where I think a lot of authors do, where they can then kind of pepper in these sort of little details that about like what kind of beer was drunk during in 1962 or whatever, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Like, I don't really have very much of that.
Yeah.
But I do try to get a sense of how people fought, I guess, is really the big thing for me.
Okay. All right. Now, Invisible Streets was published by Overlook Press, which is a different publisher than your series started with. So, and I noticed in looking online that they took on all three. It looks like you have some new covers on the other two books, and they've been re-released. So how did that come to pass that you'd be working with Overlook?
Well, I originally, with The Vault, I signed a two-book deal, and Scorched City was the second of those two books. And then when that was done, I wrote Invisible Streets, but I didn't have a publisher. And we gauged interest from St. Martin's, and they didn't seem as though they were, like, wildly interested. So we put it out to bid, and first my agent got the rights back for my first two books. So we packaged the rights to those two books plus Invisible Streets. And I, in the course of that, you know, he sends it out and the manuscript's out to, you know, it's probably 10 different editors maybe. And there's a 3-week period I think they had to read. And during that 3 weeks, the guy who became my editor at Overlook wanted to set up a phone interview, and so we talked probably for hour and a half from like broad things about the book to very narrow things, and it was just, you know, I walked away from it very energized.
Mm-hmm.
He'd obviously really thought hard about the book and really liked the things that I thought were strong about the book, and had some ideas that he thought and I thought would make the book quite a bit stronger. So when it came down to sort of getting bids in from publishers who were interested, you know, I knew that I really wanted to work with this guy, Mark, so that when they did put in a bid, I said, I definitely want to go to Overlook and work with him. And it was a pretty intense, you know, 8 months of back and forth and back and forth, and you know, he did a tremendous amount of work on it. We made some pretty major changes, wrote out a major character, a point of view character.
Oh, wow.
out of the book altogether. So it was about 8 months of editing, and then we finally ended up with the final product. But it's very different. You know, St. Martin's is so big, and they publish so many books. And they're just, their model's quite a bit different. And it was a much, you know, I was in much greater sort of communication with my editor at Overlook and spent a lot more time kind of going through plot point by plot point or, you know, can this scene be strengthened or that scene be strengthened? Whereas with St. Martin's, it was really, here's some basic things that need to be done for the next draft, and then I would do that as best I could. But there wasn't quite as much back and forth, and I think this is a different model with how they do books.
Yeah, I could see the pros and cons to that. I mean, I wonder if sometimes it was maybe a little bit frustrating because you were in closer communication with your editor, but and so the other way you felt more independent, but this way you have a lot more support. Was it both?
Yeah, you know, I don't think there were a whole lot of drawbacks to the way things went, quite honestly.
Yeah.
With Mark, I mean, we were really on the same page on, I would say, 95% of the stuff. And you know, when we didn't agree on something, we would talk it through and talk it through and talk it through. But at the end, it was always my decision.
Uh-huh.
But you know, just from talking so much and him doing line editing and him, you know, really understanding what I was trying to get across, I kind of felt as though, you know, we were so close in sort of what our final vision for the book was going to be, that most of the things that we would suggest to each other, I think we understood that the other person would think that was the right way to go.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really great process. And I know I've shown people when I've done readings, the first time I got something back from him, you know, I sent him, he had the manuscript, and he sent me the manuscript, and it was all line edited, and then he sent me a 9-page single space letter.
Oh, wow.
With, like, his ideas, all from, we need to write out this one character, down to, you know, things like, on page 158, you say that this is 3 blocks away, but on page 465, you say it's 8 blocks away, so we need to resolve this. You know, it's like that level of detail, too.
Wow.
It was really crazy. And so I show it sometimes in the readings, and people are like, oh, my God, you know, it's like he's rewriting your book. I said, you know, it's really not. I mean, I think when you have a really good editor, you know, he's not rewriting it. He's helping strengthen the stuff that you've written and bring out the stuff that you've done well, more to the forefront. So
yeah.
it was a really rewarding process, I thought.
I also, just to address one more thing about Overlook, I really like what they did with your covers, which I know is not like a huge important thing, but I think they look great. And I just wondered, were you at all involved in the cover design for the new series?
No. I think that's fortunate for everybody, because my sense of those things isn't very good. But I really like the ones that Tate Martins had done. So, you know, I kind of felt like the designers at Overlook had sort of a daunting task in front of them to come up with something that was sort of equal to what the hardcovers had looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a great job. I mean, there was a draft of each they sent by us, and then we had a few comments. You know, they weren't showing it as being a final draft. Like they weren't expecting us to say it was perfect. But so they sent it to us. We had a few comments, and then when they made those adjustments and sent them back, you know, I was really happy. And I think it is. You know, I think you know, you try and, not you personally, but people try and sort of downplay the cover and that it's, you know, it's all about the words and the book and stuff. It's like, well, you know, a physical book is a package, and you know, the cover is the first thing that people interact with, and it's got to give them sort of a sense of the mood or whatever of what's inside. And yeah, they did a great job. I was really pleased.
So you mentioned earlier that you're working on something now that's not part of the series. Are you able to talk about that at all yet, or not yet?
It's a little hard to talk in much detail about it, because I'm still, you know, my process kind of is I get these ideas and I start writing, and to a certain extent, I need to be writing to have it sort of unfold in front of me. I have a hard time thinking in the amount of detail necessary to make the plot work if I just sort of sit down and outline it. But it's more contemporary, sort of even like, you know, 2 months from now kind of future. And it really deals with, I don't know, sort of our different relationship with sort of how we deal with reality, that you know, you your interaction with your friends can be through Facebook. You know, it seems like you can sort of viscerally experience so many different things just by logging onto YouTube, and you can get a first person look at, you know, skydiving, or you know, those guys who do those wingsuits like off mountainside.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah.
And so I think you can sit in your chair and sort of at one remove have these crazy death defying experiences, or like have the sense that you're having them, and you know, some of them even get your heart pumping. But sort of the premise of the book is people who find that really objectionable and are trying to find a way to sort of, at least in their own lives, sort of introduce sort of genuine, what they consider to be sort of genuine, sort of heightened experience, and how they go about doing that.
Well, that sounds really interesting. All right, Toby, I just have one last question for you. I know that you work at the Crimes Against Children Research Center and the Family Research Lab at the University of New Hampshire. And so, and you have a family, and so it sounds like you have a really full-on life. So I wonder if you have advice for listeners who might be people who want to write but haven't made time in their lives, and what advice you might have to help them.
Yeah, so what I ended up doing is I write pretty consistently from 8 to 10 at night. So it's basically from when my daughter, who's 9, when she's getting ready for bed, basically, and then until I get, you know, too tired to continue writing very effectively. And, you know, 2 hours at a time, you know, it's not really fast, but as long as you're consistent, I find that I get, you know, month after month after month, you know, 6 or 7 months, I've come pretty close to doing a manuscript. So I think the thing really is to find in your schedule a time that you can sort of consistently set time aside for concentrated writing, and then be disciplined about it. There's always, you know, there's 100 other things you could be doing at any given time other than writing. And, you know, I struggle with that too sometimes, where I'll go through a rut where for a week or two I won't get much writing done because it always seems like there's something else. But, you know, once I get kind of into a groove on a book, I start to feel, I don't know if guilty is the word, but kind of antsy if I haven't done my writing for the day. And certainly if I skip 2 days, it certainly seems like I'm really being neglectful.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing. It's really, for me at least, it's, you know, get a schedule, stick to it, don't let yourself make excuses so that you don't do the writing. And and there'll be times when, and there are times for me when I have to put in a little bit more effort, like on weekends and things like that. But there's no, like, I have a pretty, like you said, I've got a lot of other things going on.
Right.
But I make that a priority, and I probably watch less TV or go to fewer movies than I would.
I was going
to
say, you probably don't participate in all those conversations about Breaking Bad or whatever.
No, you know, it's funny that you say that. I try not to get involved in these, you know, I get sucked into these series. I'm like, oh my god, there's 60 more shows. We spend 60 hours doing this. That was like, True Detective was perfect. It's like, okay, there's 6 shows, or 8 shows, or whatever it was. It's very finite. I can get totally sucked into it, and then it'll just be done, and I can go back to writing. So yeah, the really long series are completely lost to me, unfortunately.
Well, that's probably just as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, listen, Toby, I really appreciated you taking the time to talk to me today. I'll just mention again, the book is Invisible Streets by Toby Ball and published by Overlook. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Well, thank you.